It may not shock you to hear this, but I'm generally pro-video game. I remember telling my parents when I was a kid that all these video games that I was playing were helping me develop my hand-eye coordination and that I was making friends down at the local arcade. I'm not sure how much they really bought it or thought that I was making the right kinds of friends down at the arcade, but they generally supported my hobby. And there was eventually some science to back up my claims that video games can help with certain mental abilities and skills. I have a whole chapter in my book about brain training, where I discuss the findings and the limits of research showing that gamers tend to have better eyesight, that they can better differentiate between different kinds of visual and auditory stimuli, and how they can switch their attention from one thing to another more quickly and effectively relative to people who don't play as many games. There's even been research showing that elite StarCraft players have bigger brains. Well, at least they have tiny but detectable differences in brain areas associated with shifting attention, inhibition of impulses, and executive functions like decision-making. But I think the benefits of video games go far beyond these mental skills and swollen brains into areas that are a bit harder to quantify, but which are probably more important to our success and happiness in general. And it's less about being able to click really quickly or do a quarter circle plus punch at just the right time. It's about the experience of playing games, interacting with their systems, and dealing with people in the context of a shared goal, and the kinds of mental models and social skills that those experiences build. If we take their lessons to heart, these kinds of things can help us prepare to interact with people in the world of work, for example. Let's take a specific example. Darkest Dungeon is a game that seems to take glee in punishing players for not stepping up and putting their thinking caps on. Beating the game requires experimentation, paying attention, and learning. In it, you control a party of four adventurers and shove them into a sprawling, horror-filled dungeon. Those parties are composed of characters from 15 different classes and counting with DLC, each of which can be customized with six or more abilities and outfitted with dozens of different items. The hard part isn't so much fighting the monsters as it is analyzing the environment and adequately preparing and outfitting a party to tackle it. Bad choices result in failure, so players spend countless hours experimenting with strategies, figuring out what works, and then finding something that works even better. Video games like Darkest Dungeon require growth and skills, confidence, knowledge, tactics, and they formulated models for ramping up player achievement and teaching them how to succeed. This may involve gaining new knowledge, piecing existing knowledge together in novel ways, developing skills, or formulating new approaches to interacting with the big picture of a game's systems. Furthermore, video games encourage growth mindsets by requiring people to embrace failure as a path to learning and success instead of a dead end of frustration and demotivation. A new manager who has just been promoted because of her technical expertise, for example, may be faced for the first time with situations in which she cannot immediately and easily succeed. As with video games, defaulting to a growth mindset is extremely adaptive because it assumes that the path to success involves practice and forethought instead of just innate talent or luck. The structure of games and the episodic approach we take to them even facilitates the capture and memorization of information. And that's just one example. There are lots of other questions to consider too, like how do games teach you to handle change in the workplace or in life in general? How do they prepare you to be a good coworker, or part of a team, or friend? How do they teach you to persist through setbacks? My name is Dr. Jamie Madigan, and these are the kinds of questions that I discuss in this episode of the Psychology of Games podcast with my guest expert. Before we get on to the interview, let me just take a second to remind you that people who support me at patreon.com/POG get an ad-free version of the podcast. I ask you to support me there because it helps pay for expenses related to creating this thing, and it motivates me to keep doing it. If you can't do that or would rather not, remember that you can go to psychologyofgames.com and find out how to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, or sign up for a newsletter where I'll send you the full text of everything I publish on the site. And I publish a lot. Go see for yourself. Now, let's get on to the guest. All right, everybody, welcome to the interview portion of the podcast. I've got an interesting guest this episode. His name is John D. Harrison. I'll be calling him John throughout the rest of this episode. And one of the reasons I wanted to have John on is that he has done a lot of writing and speaking about sort of the intersection of video games and everyday life, especially how video games can improve your professional life, or more to the point, how what you learned being a gamer can improve your personal and professional life. So, John, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So your website is classicallytrained.net. So people can go there before I forget to mention it and find out more about you. But can you kind of tell us who you are and what you're doing here? Give us a little bit of an introduction.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm an author. I'm a speaker on the topic of what video games can teach us about success in our life. My interest, especially, is in the workplace. By trade, by day job, my role is in learning and organizational development, so helping other people learn and apply the skills that help them succeed. And it's been a hobby of mine of helping other people be their best at what it is they do. And I've found some interesting parallels in video games and practices that gamers use that have tremendous opportunity to be used in their work and their personal lives.
Cool. So you've sounds like you've been a gamer for quite some time.
Yes.
Back to the 80s, much like myself. I grew up in the coin operated days of like the late, well, like early 80s and on. And it sounds like you had a lot of those same experiences as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think my first exposure was in the waiting room of a car dealership. There was a Miss Pac-Man cocktail cabinet in the waiting area, and that's kind of the earliest memory I have back early 80s.
Yep, good times. So, one of the things that made me want to bring you on the podcast, like you mentioned, is that your interest is applying these things to the workplace, and you're in organizational development, OD as it's often called, and learning. And those are two realms that one field of psychology, industrial organizational psychology, typically plays a role in. I understand you're not an IO psychologist by training, but you swim in those same waters. And that those are sort of the background that I have as well. So you're one of the few people who has been applying this stuff to the world of work who isn't explicitly doing gamification, which maybe we can talk about later, but sort of more broadly, like how does this apply to being a better leader, being a better manager, being a better coach for employees? So can you give us an idea of what do you mean when you say that the same habits and traits that are practiced while playing video games can help create success in the workplace along those lines?
Yeah, certainly. It's interesting where some of our inspiration can come from. We don't always know what feeds into a certain idea at first glance, but I remember sitting down at my dining room table thinking about all my own personal experiences and areas of interest and hobbies, and I started thinking about where they overlap. And strangely enough, my professional world working with providing classes and training and development on things like time management, productivity, leading teams, working together in groups, promoting teamwork, things of that nature, started seeming like a strange and interesting parallel to a lot of the games I had played and found interest in. So I started writing out some ideas and seeing where they connected. And I kind of birthed this idea of classically trained the website from that, of how I could use these games to provide analogies and illustrations and metaphors for teaching the techniques I've seen be successful in the workplace. And there's quite a few traits that stand out, but what really caught my attention is I found a list in an article that was looking at the skills that hiring managers said were important and also lacking in the workplace. And on that list were things like collaboration, the idea of teamwork, working together, being adaptable, being able to handle change, being able to learn and share that knowledge with teammates, innovation, and one that isn't necessarily a typical soft skill we hear a lot about, but the idea of personal accountability, being able to take ownership for your decisions. And I started thinking about where those might appear in games, and the answers came to my mind relatively quickly. So I've spent a lot of time
Everywhere.
exploring those. Right.
So what did you find when you started getting into that topic?
Well, I noticed that there existed the language to describe them within the games. And I think one that I want to point out, we can mention it early on because it's the one I just recently mentioned, the accountability. Accountability is one of those traits that I've worked with a lot of leaders and managers, supervisors who have expressed their frustration about team members not taking responsibility for their own work and have asked, how do you draw that out of people? One of the funny things about accountability is you can't really hold other people accountable. You can hold consequences to them and rules to them, but you can't really make them feel that sense of responsibility for their own work. That's something that comes from within. So what I found is that these same individuals who might not have that sense of responsibility in that context of the work environment were exhibiting it when they would play video games. And so when you think about playing a game, if you enter into a game, and let's say it's an exploration game, we can use something like Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. It's a great game. A lot of people are playing it. It's fantastic. You see something in the distance, whether it's a treasure chest or an item that you want, and your first thought isn't, well, when is someone going to bring that to me? Or why is that so hard? Why did they put that in the mountain? Why do I have to defeat these enemies to get that chest? It should just be here at my feet. No, you figure out, how do I get to that? What do I have to do? What is it that I'm responsible for that I can do to reach this objective? And so as a game player, you figure out and you try different things and you take responsibility for your actions as you're trying to solve this puzzle. And when you finally get it, you have this great sense of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And the idea was like, you know, if I can communicate that same idea to a worker and tell them, you know, I want you to think about a promotion in that same way, or is this task or this workplace skill in that same way, ask yourself that question, what can I do to make it come about? How can I solve this? How can I treat it as if it were a game? And would I see a different result as opposed to waiting around for others to notice?
So do you think that translates into team context? Like if you're playing a multiplayer game and you know, your team loses because you were terrible in your role, or you know, you made poor decisions on how to upgrade your character during the match, and your team is saying, you're a terrible healer, you're a terrible tank. It seems like those sort of concepts will come into play there as well for honest players who are self-aware, who might realize that, like, I did, you know, do a terrible job healing. You know, I was out there trying to get kills instead of keeping my teammates alive, or I was, you know, not on the objective, or I was not playing the map's objectives, or something along those lines. And that seems like that could be a trait that would correlate with success, you know, in the game as well. So if you learn from those mistakes and you maybe even at the outset set out to think like, okay, well, what can I do that can directly contribute to, you know, the performance of the team? Then those are going to be the types of players that you would want to have on your team and on your friends list.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the idea of better questions that we ask ourselves lead to better answers. And asking that better question, you know, what can I do? How can I be better at this is definitely part of it. But you also said something important, is the idea of being self-aware. And not everyone has that, as we know far too well. And we do hear the excuses both in the workplace and life, and as well as even the games. You know, people are quick to blame lag or controller inputs or any other number of things. But what's kind of embedded in that, it's funny because another thing came to mind, the idea of the fundamental attribution error. This idea that when you were talking about a team player identifying someone else and saying, oh, well, they're a bad healer or they're not good at that, is this idea to right away see others' actions and label their character and label their performance based on what we see.
Right.
But when we ourselves fall into the trap, we quickly revert to, oh, well, I'm just having a bad day. That's not like me. That's not normal. And even
it's
that's
some
the
external
opportunity.
Force to blame, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And even that's the opportunity to share with others. Yeah, you see, this is something that happens. And when we start to notice it, then we can become self-aware and combat it in ourselves more so than when we see it in others.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So I, in preparation for this interview, I read through your book, which is, by the way, I'm not sure if we mentioned or not, Mastering the Game, What Video Games Can Teach Us About Success in Life. And I actually think that you should have mentioned the workplace somewhere in the title, because the majority of the book is actually more about these workplace topics. So like, you know, how can we improve management, or how can I be a better employee taking lessons of video games? But I thought one of the interesting chapters for me, one of the ones that sort of fit in with industrial organizational psychology the most, was the one on change management and sort of what video games can tell us about change management. So change management is pretty much what it sounds like. It's like affecting change, especially changes to like institutions or ingrained ways that work is done. So it's not like a habit. It's not on the personal level. It's more like changing the organization or changing the culture. either in response to new technology or a new structure, new development in the marketplace, or getting bought and acquired and merged with another company is sort of the most drastic, you know, change management scenario. But what can video games teach us about how to manage that kind of change well?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. There's a couple things that I talk about in the book. I do use rather a silly and loose analogy from the game Katamari Damacy to kind of put a chocolate coating on top of the broccoli, if you will, yeah. of John Cotter's approach to change management. And he has essentially eight key roles that he uses to explain change. And then I look for those same examples existing in the game. So I use them to illustrate it. And so that's somewhat tongue in cheek. But beyond that silly analogy, there really are some important things to point out within change management. Our workplace, the world around us is constantly evolving. The video game industry is a great microcosm example of that, where it's a newer industry, it's younger. And so we can see there's this dramatic change. If you look back to the late 70s and what games looked like then, and mm-hmm. what video games were thought of in terms of everything from who the target audience is to how meaningful they were, could they tell stories? Music was something that you didn't find a lot of in early games. Mm-hmm. To now, you have entire orchestral scores. You have hundreds, if not thousands, of developers working on some of the big AAA titles where, you know, a top seller back in the day might have one, maybe two people working on it.
Right.
Even just in the industry, you can see the tremendous change that's occurred. I think every time a player picks up a new game, they're faced with their own type of change, their own change that they have to deal with. Even games and sequels, when you see a game building on a previous game, there's new control schemes, there's new mechanics. And the idea being that you have to rapidly learn what's changed, what's different, what's new. How do I have to adapt my strategies to this new environment, this new set of rules? And I think just the practice of doing that is helpful when it comes to change. But one of the things that games do really well is they give you that constant motivation.
Right.
And they give you kind of some reasons to change. Part of it is the process itself. And I think that being thought out is how do we help the player adapt to this new change or this new system? I think we see a lot of thought put into it with games and the ones that don't have that kind of struggle. Whereas in the workplace, we tend to push change down on people with not always as much thought or communication put into it. Mm-hmm. And that's one difference that I've kind of noticed from the manager's standpoint that they could benefit from having a little more clarity on.
On what they need to try, what habits they need to develop, or inspiration for ways to approach it. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, everything. One of the principles within Cotter's framework is the idea of short-term wins, of mm-hmm. being able to find a success early on that you can latch on to, and that you can communicate and over-communicate and stress and emphasize to keep the momentum high. And I think games are really good at emphasizing short-term wins, short-term goals, as well as the longer term. And too often in the workplace, we'll put out a giant vision or a giant idea or a giant goal, and we don't always take the time to celebrate the steps along the way, realizing that that can lead to disengagement when we fail to engage and celebrate some of those early wins.
Yeah. Video game, the successful ones have that down to a science, right, where they're engineering like these short small term wins that all stack up to some large term achievement and development in your character and the narrative, or something about the game introduces some new game mechanic, and they are a lot of times real masterful in just sort of setting out a breadcrumb of those little things that leads the player along, that onboards, you know, her until she's comfortable taking on more advanced changes. And pretty soon by the end of the game, you're doing something that would have been overwhelming at the beginning of the game, but you're doing it easily and you're having fun doing it. So yeah, it seems like video games, and I've written about this and talked about this as well in other places, like that is like motivation via rewards and incremental behavior changes and developing habits are like one of the things games do better than any other medium and any other sort of sphere in life. So I can definitely see that as well. And I just recently read an article that talked about like the power of small wins. You know, and when you look at like what makes employees engaged, and you talk about this like employee engagement or worker engagement, it's a sort of feeling of like focus and intensity and characterized by like internal motivation. Like people are doing the job because they love doing the job, and it's internally motivating. It's fun for its own sake. It's done for its own sake. And one of the things that predicts whether or not some employees are going to be engaged in that way is whether or not they have a sense of progress throughout their day. So, right. You know, do they come into work and they faced with a mountain of, you know, work and calls to deal with and emails that they never get out from underneath, and they go home feeling like they've accomplished nothing? Or do their managers and the organization and the tools surrounding them give them some sort of sense of like, okay, you did these things today and they contributed in this way, and now like the company or your department or you personally are better off in these ways because of what you did. So even like somebody doing the same exact work, depending on how like it's framed and set up, can give a person much more of a sense of internal motivation, and then with other things in play that can lead to much higher engagement in their work.
Yeah, and the engagement piece is huge. There are many games that I think have lost people because they don't necessarily enroll them well or don't engage directly. Mm-hmm. But the ones that do it best typically answer three questions in my experience. And they're the same three questions that I think every leader of any organization should be able to focus on. And the first one is, what am I doing?
Yeah.
So getting really clear on what am I doing?
Yeah.
Right. Why am I doing it?
Yeah. Not always clear. Yeah.
Which isn't always clear, especially in organizations. In games, a lot of them will have a narrative, and the ones that you feel really connected with have that clear why behind it. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is, as the player or as an employee, where do I fit in?
Right.
And again, in games, the role that you play is typically pretty clear in the bigger picture. It's almost a given. It's hard to not have that. The challenge in the workplace is oftentimes managers and supervisors might be really clear on what their job is. They might have their own spark or idea behind why they're doing it. But if they don't translate back to the employee where they fit into that bigger picture, mm-hmm. it's really challenging to engage with it because there's that lack of that sense of connection or higher meaning, or often the gamification space, they call it epic meaning, the idea of something bigger than yourself to be a part of, right?
Yeah. yeah. Okay. That all makes sense. So what about like, one of the other chapters you talked about is team building and collaboration, which seems like a natural fit video games, right? Especially, or at least some video games, multiplayer ones, social ones, ones where players have to work together, either together or asynchronously or somehow. What have you found out about what video games can teach us about team building and how to be a good teammate and how to collaborate with other people?
That's a great question. There's a lot of research around the different types of players and categories of them that I personally have not dug into in my written work because I'm more interested in the positive sides of it. I'm a little less interested in those who are looking to actively sabotage.
Yeah, it's always more interesting, right?
You know, well, I let human resources.
Who wants to read a thriller about a saint? Give me the serial killer. That's the real interesting stuff.
Well, I would prefer to let the employee relations team deal with that. So
true.
I want to help the high performers get better. And as such, it's about optimizing that teamwork. And it ties into a little bit about what we were just talking about, the idea of if we can focus on what our shared common vision, our shared common mission is. Games that are team-based online naturally have that shared thought process, have that common goal. It's built into the structure. It's not always as clear in the workplace. And when it's not clear, the tendency of people is to create their own clarity for themselves, which unfortunately can lead to a lot of silos within organizations where rather than seeing the challenge for what it is, our tendency is to just focus on how do I protect our own department's resources? How do I prevent that competition with those internal threats? Because no one's really done a good job of clarifying the external threats. That kind of goes back to leadership and clarity. But when it's working well, the thought process that I wrote about when I approached the book was a bit more individual-centric. And the thought process behind that is, as a member of a team, you're wearing many hats. You're playing different roles. You're playing the role of an individual contributor who has their own responsibilities, but you also are interconnected with others. There are those who you're going to need to mentor and train when it comes to things like succession planning and being able to pass on your knowledge, having that knowledge transfer and show others and teach others what you do and how you do it, and hopefully a little bit of why. But also the need to connect with a mentor of sorts and to have role models within the workplace, to have others that you work along with. And the analogies I use in my book kind of break the game space, that fourth wall. And I use the analogy of who's your player two. Because growing up in back in my day, you know, the player one and player two were both in the same room. And there is that interaction experience, and people took different roles. And so there was an opportunity to figure out, how do I interact with this person? Are they the kind of person that's going to be helpful and share those goals? Or are they going to be someone that can carry me in tough times? Or am I going to have to carry them? And understanding your relationship to those in your team and those around you is an important part of being successful in any team.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. So what about when things don't go so well and an individual or a team has to kind of tough it out and persist through tough times? You know, I've written about, and we were talking a little bit about before we started recording, about Angela Duckworth's research on grit and persistence, which is this idea of, it's a characteristic of people who, when they set out to do something and encounter setbacks or difficulties, then they buckle down and they redouble their efforts and they keep sort of grinding at it as necessary to eventually succeed. And that's as opposed to somebody who might say, like, well, this is obviously not for me, and I'm going to go find something that's easier, more convenient, or something I'll be more successful at more readily. And then there's all this research about how people who possess grit tend, you know, it's something on par with general cognitive ability in terms of like predicting success in life and work. Like, if you have grit, you can make up for flaws or shortcomings in other areas, because you'll keep at it until you succeed, and you'll find better strategies for succeeding than even smart people who don't have grit.
Right. And that's where it so neatly pairs up with Carol Dweck's work around mindset. And the difference, of course, between having a fixed mindset or a growth mindset, and understanding, is this something that's doable, that I can have build efficacy and that I can learn, or is this something that is limited and I have a certain amount of talent that's fixed, and that being the, you know, less desirable of the two. What's interesting about video games and grit, and also that intersection with the mindset, growth mindset, is that it's been a tremendous experience for me, actually, as a father. I have a 7-year-old son, and I've been using video games as my training ground to help him build grit and to build that that growth mindset. And when you play a difficult game, it's that sense of, I want to go back for more. I want to figure out, how do I overcome this challenge? How do I stick with this? Rather than just rage quitting, tossing the controller aside, or saying, I give up, I can't do this. Games have a safe way of pushing us to our limits. Especially, I like to pick on the games of the 80s and the 90s. They tended to focus a bit more on that higher level of challenge. We've made the phrase referencing Dark Souls as kind of the new wave of, oh, that's the Dark Souls of, you know, fill in the blank, meaning that it's incredibly challenging and unforgiving. Most people who use that phrase have either forgotten or never knew that there were games like Ninja Gaiden, Castlevanias, Battletoads, Silver Surfer. You know, there were some
Ghouls and Goblins, or Ghosts and Goblins, I guess. Maybe one of the two.
Well, there's at least two of them. So
I remember those. Those quarter crunchers, those controller breaking difficult games. Yep.
And part of that, it's a whole different issue that we don't have to go down the path. But part of it was just the nature of the arcade. And you didn't want people spending a long time per quarter. You wanted to kind of cycle through the credits quickly. But what that gave opportunity for also is mastery. and building self-efficacy in the process of knowing, well, you know what? I stuck with that challenging game. I beat it. Maybe I can do the same for this game that I've never played. And so then begins the learning curve and the onboarding and the learning phase of how you pick up the new skills and orienting to the new game. The idea being is that same mindset, that same mentality, that same persistence of sticking with it and patience that it takes to grind out in these games serves individuals incredibly well when it comes to studying for school, when it comes to applying yourself in your job, when it comes to facing workplace challenges of being the person who says, you know what, let me give this one more go. Let me try this new angle. Let me approach it in a slightly different way. And rather than seeing each failure as an end point, see it as a learning opportunity of saying, okay, so when I try this, here's the outcome. How can I do this a little differently? And I think games are really good at training that skill. The trick is making the connection that you can do the same thing at work.
Right. So do you have any thoughts on what the mechanism for that might be? That if somebody develops grit in the context of playing games, and I can see that carrying from game to game or even genre of game or type of game, you know, between that, what's the mechanism then for applying that grit to the workplace or to school or to anything else? Is it just an attitude that's developed or a trait that's developed, or do people come up with specific strategies that worked in video game challenges and apply similar or identical strategies to workplace challenges?
Historically, my experience with that has been anecdotal for the most part. It's typically the exception of the individual who has that aha moment where they connect the dots and say, you know what, applying for that job that I want, getting that promotion that I want, that's like a game and I'm going to treat it as such. And when individuals adopt that mindset, that gameful mindset as they approach things, it tends to work really well for them. The challenge is explaining to others that you can carry that over. And I think that's where we don't always do a good job of connecting those dots. When we take games, whether it's video games or whether it's board games or card games or any challenge, even sports, we tend to see it a bit more in sports.
When we
take those pastimes or hobbies, as they've been labeled, or others call them a waste of time, when you label it that way and you set it to the side and say, I'm not interested in your game, I'm not interested in your hobby, you're at work now, I think we do ourselves a disservice. And not acknowledging the value that those bring is one of our greatest opportunities, that if you lead people and you know that they have participated in this sort of experience games, it's your chance to say, guys, let's treat this like a game.
So do those kinds of conversations or those ways of framing an issue come into play a lot with the organizational development and learning work that you do in your day-to-day job? Do you employ those strategies to get people on board and to get them, you know, to get the attention and get the involvement of people who are receptive to those kinds of stories and analogies?
I think that's going to depend on the workplace that you're in. The workplace I'm currently in is very supportive of it. I'm in a not-for-profit private university. And so I have a tremendous opportunity to be able to bring that part of my skill set and experience and approach to the workplace. I've been able to use it in departmental training sessions. I've been able to use the analogies with certain teams that are a bit more experienced with games. We have a great IT department that, you know, while it is somewhat stereotypical to say that, being able to speak to them about the latest games and parallel those ideas into the workplace is a very natural fit.
Yeah.
And I think within higher ed, there's a general acceptance and appreciation for the ideas. I don't know that every place is going to be as receptive. I can tell you that healthcare is a little less receptive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My own experience with that has been they're a little less receptive to apply that. But we have to give it time. Yeah. I think as time persists and we're able to get past blaming games for violence and for terrible things and start acknowledging more of the positive contributions that exist out there, I think that we're going to have more inroads and more opportunities, especially as we have a generation growing up that this has been a form of entertainment that's been around for anyone born in the 80s and later. This is something that has always been around.
Or even earlier, yeah. I mean, I think that you and I, to the extent that we're part of the same generation, are part of the first generation that grew up with video games. So, I mean, even if you were born in the 1970s, by the time you were 10 years old and able to do that sort of stuff, games were becoming part of the culture. And then, you know, the majority of people in the United States play games regularly, even if it's on like a cell phone or a computer or on a website. Games are very much part of our common, you know, cultural fabric. Everybody is familiar with games. And even if you don't consider yourself a, you know, a gamer, quote unquote, or a hardcore gamer, you probably know somebody who is, or you're the parent of someone who is, or the sibling. And it seems like that day should have arrived by now, or is here. And I kind of draw the analogy to, you know, you say like, well, it depends on the workplace and some people are more receptive of it than others, but you never hear anybody complain about a coach or a manager or somebody getting up and giving like a sports analogy, right? Like
right.
Talking about how our team needs to march down the gridiron and complete the plays and be strategic in our choice of, you know, this or that and, you know, hit a home run or tee things up or, you know, we weren't really playing up to par, you know, last quarter. The sports analogies are everywhere. And I don't quite understand why video game analogies don't work as well. I guess they just haven't permeated the popular culture and the popular way of speaking that everybody shares. But it's going to take people like, you know, you and me to make that happen. So we're, you know, you're doing the good work. You're fighting for that day when a, you know, first person shooter analogy is as applicable as a baseball analogy.
And you are right saying that we were right on the cusp there, because there are some phrases I have continued to hear. I think level up is one that is starting to become more commonplace. People talking about leveling up your skills, obviously referencing back to mini role-playing games. And I do start to hear some of that. You know, I think there's someone out there who had some interesting ideas. Jordan Voight Roberts, he was the director of the movie Kong Skull Island.
Oh, yeah.
And younger gentleman, he's, again, our age, and he talked about how this generation is growing up with video games as a language that we speak in common, and gives it that parallel to being a language itself. And that when you think about games, there's a certain language that says, if I push this object or if I shoot this object with an arrow, it's going to unlock a hidden doorway. Mm. That sort of logic doesn't hold water in the real world, but within the game world, it does. And so that kind of shapes our thinking as we're growing up in the way that comic books have found success in the film industry now, where for years they hadn't. Mm-hmm. There's that popularizing of those ideas. And so I think it's only a matter of time before we have that stronger permeation and stronger representation across the board, even in the workplace.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait. So you mentioned earlier and kind of alluded to a few times the concept of gamification, which is applying game-like concepts to non-game scenarios, such as, you know, workplace, consumer activity, political activity, that kind of stuff. How do you think that industry or that field is shaping up, and what does it look like relative to what you do?
You know, it was one of those buzzwords that I have to admit, I cringed early on when I first heard the label gamification. I've come to terms with it, though it still kind of stumbles coming out of my mouth. But it's not as new of an idea as it's portrayed as. It's been a fad for a little while, and I think it's found a little ground and is leveled out a bit. But the idea that you can take game mechanics and apply them to the workforce or to work that perhaps lacks a certain level of motivation, but if you make it more like a game, you're going to be able to engage your workforce, hopefully driving efficiencies and ultimately profits and or outcomes that you're desiring as an organization. You know, I laugh again. Like I said, it goes back to Mary Poppins about whistling while you work. You know,
right.
You know, or I guess that's Snow White. Yes, yeah. Right. Make a game of it. But one of the things that's overlooked is that it comes down to a lot of companies trying to put badges and achievements, create point systems and create leaderboards. And oftentimes the environment itself is ignored. In other words, there's not proper consideration given if these type of mechanics are going to suit the nature of the work. And when you deal with knowledge work, when you deal with work that relies on creativity and thought processes, creating a competitive environment, creating one that is overly measured, actually damages the ability to create good breakthrough and successful innovation. And so in some ways, just the nature of gamification can be too rigid as it's typically used. And as I mentioned, its typical application is low level, positive reinforcement,
right,
and creating recognition systems. But the other problem that I see with it and why it typically fails in its current form, even with strong implementation out of the gate, is the tendency to overlook the other side of the equation, which is the player. And central to any game being fun, if you think about it, is the desire to want to play, of having the agency to choose that you wish to engage in a game, knowing that if you decide this isn't fun, you can stop and you can switch or you can play the game as you wish. These systems too often are pushed down from the top and typically don't take into consideration feedback from the person who's involved with the playing. Right. And so then they tend to fizzle out pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think to borrow like a concept that I hear a lot of people in like communications, academic researchers in communications, you know, games are co-created. So like the game developer will set up, you know, boundaries in terms of rules and mechanics, but then the player decides what to do within those boundaries, and the player decides like when to jump on the Goomba's head or jump over the Goomba or how to proceed through a level and so forth. And gamification systems a lot of times ignore that kind of thing, and they ignore the player's agency and the player's role in co-creating that experience. Or they oversimplify it to say, you know, you have just done these things. Like, here's a running list of the things you have done. And yeah, I'm kind of a similar mind. Gamification tends to ignore a lot of the psychology and economics and communications behind why games work, and just oversimplify the badges, leaderboards, type of information without thinking about like, okay, well, why would people find a leaderboard motivating, or why would people find a reward in something worth pursuing and doing what you ask of them, and not just the fact that it's there. You know, not everybody's gonna climb Mount Everest simply because it's there. Some of us require a pretty good reason to do something like that.
Right. And if the mechanisms aren't thought out or implemented well enough, sometimes you'll promote the wrong types of behaviors in pursuit of whatever those rewards end up being. So that's also something to be cautious about.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine like anything else, doing gamification really well is really difficult, really expensive, and requires a certain areas of expertise, and there's not a quick answer to doing it the way that people, you know, might want a turnkey solution for other problems or other issues. So what else are you working on these days? Got anything coming up or any other projects that people should be on the lookout for?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked. Actually in the midst
funny
of
how that work.
Yes. Midst of writing book number two.
Cool.
And the title, tentative title of that is If Video Games Have Taught Me Anything, A Strategy Guide to Your Life.
Okay.
It's built up of stories of how video games can help you be the hero of your story. And so I've reached out to others who range from any number of job titles across all ages, genders, ethnicities, backgrounds, everything from musicians to CEOs of companies to frontline employees to actors that you might recognize their name. Not going to drop any names just yet.
save it for the press tour. Yep.
Right. But ask them kind of that question, you know, what's something you've learned from video games? And it's a collection of stories that are threaded together by a theme. with the intent of inspiring others to be that voice for positivity. And it's designed to be something that whether you're in school as a student, whether you're an individual, a professional in the workplace, or if you're a parent, even a grandparent of someone who enjoys games, it's a chance to connect with a world that has a lot of positives, a lot of upsides to it, and hopefully inspire some others to really connect with these ideas and create some positivity of their own as inspired by games. And embedded in this is this idea that I had occurred to me and kind of on a whim. It's a cute little catchphrase. It's a little too cute,
Let's
but
it's
one life, no continues.
Oh, okay.
And it came from this idea of going back to the arcades, that you'd be on that last quarter and you've got that last life and, you know, one touch, that's it, the game's over. How do you play when you're down to your last quarter? You take calculated risk. You look to get every extra value, every moment, every positive experience you can, and enjoy it for what it is, and preserve it, but at the same time, not be so safe that you put yourself at risk as well. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to present everyone with that same opportunity to treat your life that way, to explore those opportunities and find that fulfillment and meaning, but realize that time is precious. And it's important that you take that analogy outside of the game and see that you're spending your time on the things that matter to you, so that you don't reach the end of your own life and realize that you didn't spend time on the things you wanted to.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the heart and the core of that book, wrapped up in a lot of fun stories from other people.
Cool. I dig it. Yeah. It's great to hear that sort of stuff, because a lot of the headlines are related to video games, or, you know, violence in video games, addiction, loot boxes, you know, ruining relationships, or, you know, unhealthy, because people are just sitting around playing games instead of being active. And those are all like important topics and need to be explored, especially by through proper scientific research, as I always, you know, point out. But in addition to that, like, there's a lot of great stuff about video games and people's experiences with them and the things that they have done for people. So I'm always fond, or I always hate saying in real life, you know, as opposed to in video games, you know, to contrast video games with in real life, because like video games are part of real life. They're part of our, you know, what we do for entertainment and what we do to socialize. So that sounds like a really cool idea for a book. I look forward to checking it out. So last couple of questions before we wrap up. Have you been playing anything? You had time to play any games that aren't like coin operated quarter crunchers from the 80s and 90s?
Well, okay, so you almost disqualified me with that. You know, because the Street Fighter 30th anniversary collection just came out, and I've been playing that.
That's pretty good, as like an archive or museum quality, you know, collection.
Yeah. And so it's interesting from that perspective. Frank Cifaldi and his team over at Digital Eclipse have been a part of Capcom's work. They did it with the first Mega Man Legacy Collection, and they've been asked to do it with the Street Fighter Collection. And so they're assembling these archives, or if you will, it's the parallel would be like the Criterion Collection, of these video games to appear and behave the way that they appeared originally. Mm-hmm. Not giving them the HD treatment necessarily, but in the process, they've also archived a lot of the original work that went into designing it, the design documents, the artist renditions and sketches, and the failed starts, and the history behind it. And so, from a historical perspective, collections like these are fascinating. Also very humbling and reminding of one's own mortality when I realize it really has been 30 years this game came out.
30 years ago, yeah. Before I learned to do that fireball motion for the first time.
Right, right. So
25 since I did the Dragon Punch, maybe.
Yes. So aside from that, I have been playing a lot of the Nintendo Switch. It's a great system.
What are you playing on there?
I'm still playing a lot of Breath of the Wild. I've been playing a lot of the independent games. Again, I guess this is dating me so bad because I keep referencing the old games being re-released on new systems. Ikaruga was a treasure top-down shooter that came out in the late 90s that just got a digital release.
Where you switch from dark to light.
Right, you have the two polarities.
Light. Yeah,
right.
And like white obstacles would be affected by dark, but and vice versa.
Right,
like
so
that.
You have yeah. damage reduction, and then you have damage enhancing boost for things that are the
opposite color.
So yeah. you're constantly switching between these while dodging thousands of projectiles on screen.
Those bullet hell games I just cannot do. Maybe take us back to the persistence and grit question, but like I cannot get through those games. My brain doesn't work that way. Yeah.
And the other thing that's been neat for me is I've been playing with my 7-year-old. Where I just started introducing him. So he's been playing a lot of Mario Odyssey on the Switch, which has been fun because there's a lot of exploration, a lot of experimentation. And so I just sit with him and we engage in dialogue and have questions of, you know, what's another way of doing that? Or do you think you could get up there? Why don't you try to get up there and see what you can do? And having those... what I hope to be persistent and grit building opportunities and having dialogue about it outside the game has been something that's been enjoyable for both of us. So that's been a lot of fun as well.
Yeah. I've taken a little bit of a break from my Switch, although I still have Breath of the Wild on there that I need to get through and play some more. I've done 3 of the 4 Divine Beasts. So, you know, within striking distance of finishing the main story on that, though I hear there's just tons of stuff to explore and the DLC and all of that. I'm waiting for the Dark Souls Remastered to come out on the Switch, which will be the Dark Souls of Switch games. I think it'll be interesting to play it with mobile. I played all of those games, loved them all. I'm a huge Dark Souls fan, so I played each of them at least a couple of times through. And kind of want to experience the original Dark Souls game with, you know, modern, on a more modern console. It's like out for Xbox and PC and PlayStation 4 right now, but I'm waiting for the Switch. It got delayed. And probably more the reason for that than I want to admit is to buy the little amiibo that's the Solaire, the little dude, you know, the Praise the Sun guy.
Yes.
I don't own a single amiibo, but I will do whatever it takes to acquire that one.
Oh boy.
Because it's just so cool.
You know, that's got to be a good exercise for anyone who's aspiring to be a stoic, is to try playing Dark Souls in public and contain the
rage.
The, the physiology and the responses that your body is going to be suppressing.
Yeah.
So
I did that once. I was at a few years ago before Dark Souls 3 came out, or right before it came out, I was at a Comic Con like convention here in town, and they had kiosks set up with Dark Souls 3. And you could see people like walk up to that game who had never played a Dark Souls game, or even people like me who had, but you know, it had been a while and we weren't used to like how exactly the dodge worked in this armor set that they had set up, you know, for this character in the kiosk, and people just throwing the controller down, like walking away, just like, this game's stupid. It's fun to watch, but
that's fantastic.
I'll wait for that. I finished God of War, the new one, was good. I wasn't quite as smitten with it as other people. It took, I actually dropped off of it and stopped playing for a few weeks and then thought like, I'll go finish that one weekend and put in the time to finish it up. But liked it. It was pretty good. I enjoyed that. And I'm just playing a lot of Heroes of the Storm, which is the MOBA from Blizzard. And that has just sort of taken up my, you know, I got 20 or 30 minutes that I could spend playing a game. I'll play a match or two of Heroes of the Storm. So, yep, that's what I've been filling in. Well, thanks so much for coming on and talking about this stuff. It's really interesting. And look forward to the new book coming out. And, thanks again.
Absolutely my pleasure. I love the work you're doing as well.
As always, thanks for listening to another episode of the Psychology Games Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it, and if you've got stories or thoughts to share about how video games prepared you to succeed in work or life in general, I'd love to hear about them. Leave a comment in the show notes for this episode at psychologyofgames.com, or click on the connect link at the top of the page to find out how to email me or tell me on Twitter. I'm @JamieMadigan there. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next episode.